Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, designing peace in divided societies. And first, climate change, receding glaciers, and melting ice sheets are causing the oceans to dramatically rise. What does that mean for the world's coastal cities? Average global sea levels will rise by 20 to 30 feet, say researchers. What could the rise mean for coastal cities all over the Earth? Two experts join us. Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Florida. She is the author of Ice Volumes and Sea Level During the Last Interglacial that was published in the journal Science. Brian Fagan is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of more than 40 books, including The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. Welcome, Andrea Dutton, Brian Fagan. Great to have you both with us. Brian Fagan, I want to begin with you, your research for the book, The Attacking Ocean. Let's start with where you start, the Ice Age. Sea levels, you said, were something like 120 meters lower than they are today. But the change was gradual. How did this start and come up to where we are today?
Well, basically, over the last 10,000 years, as I understand it, there was a fairly rapid rise after the Ice Age when warming began. It was irregular, but the rising continued. And then about 6,000 BC, maybe around there, maybe a little later, things stabilized. And there was a long period when there were very minor changes. And then after 1860, the rise has resumed and I believe now is accelerating. So it's a sort of pattern of stop and start.
The rise that was occurring before the stable period, what do we know about what was causing it then?
This is really, I think, more in Andrew's area than mine. But what was going on was that the Ice Age was ending. There was widespread global warming. There was extensive melting of the ice sheets which covered North America and covered Scandinavia and elsewhere. And sea levels began to rise with this discharge of meltwater into the ocean. And then you also got very complex and little understood adjustments of the Earth's crust going on, which varied considerably from one area to another. And the result was that the geography of much of the world changed. I mean, Scandinavia and Alaska were separated. The continental shelf that practically joined Southeast Asia to Australia was vanished underwater. You've got the North Sea was flooded by 5500 BC. England was separated from the Channel and so on. There were very, very radical changes. This apart from changes in vegetation and so on. But the shifts in recent years have been, quite dramatic. What is going on at the moment, I'm told, is a little more cooling than usual. So the point about climate change and all these things is that they're not regular. They vary tremendously. And you get cycles where not much happened, then you get a cycle where things happened. And this is true of all climate change.
Andrea Dutton, let's bring you in. Now, you've also looked back as far as the Ice Age. Why do we start there?
What we were just talking about, coming out of this last Ice Age, this is a time period when you had large ice sheets covering vast portions of the northern hemisphere. And as we were just talking about, those ice sheets retreated and sea level rose. And then it stabilized somewhat. So when we're talking about sea level change, and particularly looking into the future, we don't actually really want to be thinking about the changes that happened between the Ice Age and today. That was a very different dynamic of these ice sheets over these large continents in the northern hemisphere. What we really want to understand now is what's happening to these large polar ice sheets that we still have in Greenland and Antarctica, and what's going to happen to them as we go into the future. So that's the reason my research actually focuses on periods of time in the past that are warm periods when we had ice sheets in a similar configuration to today, so meaning ice on Greenland and Antarctica, to understand how sensitive those ice sheets are to changes in temperature.
I suppose that is what you meant by radiative forcing?
Yes. So one of the main drivers, of course, is how much of the sun's energy is coming into the Earth at a given time. And so one of the periods that I study is called the last interglacial. So that's before the last ice age, when sea levels were higher than today. But the temperatures were pretty similar, but a few degrees warmer at the poles. And one difference back then is that the northern hemisphere was receiving a lot more solar radiation during the summertime, which we think had something to do with the warmer temperatures there. What we're looking at today, though, is a very different scenario. So what's driving the climate change? The changes are, for one thing, happening much faster. Temperature is changing much faster. And the forcing in terms of the increase in temperature is global scale. It's not focused just in the northern hemisphere. The increase in CO2 in our atmosphere is causing the entire globe to warm.
Brian Fagan, you actually opened your book with these storms that are occurring, particularly with Katrina and Sandy, and how massive they have become and more frequent they have become. How are these things related? How come climate change translates into these storms, and how is that all related to sea level?
The most important thing about rising sea levels and extreme weather events, and I believe the climatologists, and Ajahn may know more about this than I do, are predicting there are going to be many more severe events. The big real threat, human-wise, is obviously strong winds and so on, but it is the sea surges which accompany these and which inundate densely populated coastal areas, of which, of course, New Jersey is one. The real serious problem in the immediate future is Bangladesh, which is, as you know, very prone to cyclones. And this whole area, which lies very close to sea level, has very dense populations in the millions. And the effects of this mean that millions of people are basically losing their land permanently in the long term, apart from the dangers of contamination of groundwater and so on. And we're going to be facing an issue of environmental refugees, which is going to get very serious globally, I think.
You actually mentioned a few other places in the book in addition to Bangladesh. You talked about the Pacific Islands. You mentioned the Bahamas. You mentioned Vietnam. What is the scope as a big problem for issues of climate refugees?
The big issue is acceptance. For example, if you take Bangladesh, and let's say, just for the sake of argument, they need to move 10 million people, where are they going to go? They're not going to go to Myanmar, and Myanmar doesn't want them. India doesn't want them. Apart from political and social stresses, they have serious problems themselves. And the only alternative is to develop international policies which deal with a very, very difficult problem, which is the moving of subsistence farmers who have very close emotional relationships to their land into countries that will accept them where they have no skills which are useful in the modern industrial economy. And this is a very, very serious problem because it intersects problems in every single nation and areas like South Dakota, where I'm sitting, which are hundreds of miles from the ocean, because where are people going to go?
And there's also vulnerable parts in the U.S. you mentioned. You said it was concentrated in the South.
Mainly in the South because of the nature of the shoreline and the just the geology and so on. And the parts of the East are very vulnerable. The West Coast is not quite so bad. But the real, real problem areas beyond the Arctic, obviously, are places like Shanghai, low-lying areas where there rarely are millions of people in the way in urban environments, and you have the option. Do you wall them off or at vast expense, or do you pay the bills when it happens and people die or whatever? And these are very serious problems which are going to come home to roost more and more, I think, in the next century.
Andrea Dutton, let's bring you back in here. It sounded like the work that you're doing suggests that the average global sea level can rise 20 to 30 feet?
Yes, that's right. So this time period I mentioned before, the last interglacial, where it was only a couple degrees warmer at the poles, what we've done is we've gone back and looked at what elevation we can find fossil corals. So corals grow close to the sea surface, and that's one method we can use to reconstruct where sea level was in the past. So a lot of the sites that I go to, you can see these corals sticking way above sea level now. And we've determined that the peak sea level during this time period was probably between about 5.5 to 9 meters above present sea level. So that's something like 18 to almost 30 feet.
Do we have a sense of how soon that will happen?
That is the multi-billion dollar question, right? We know that sea level rise is inevitable in our future. And so what we want to know, what everyone wants to know, is how much, and in particular, how quickly is that going to happen? That's a very difficult question to answer because the models that we have about the physics of how these ice sheets will respond dynamically like this are basically not good enough for us to do good projections into the future. And that's why I've taken the approach of looking into the past, and we're trying to determine when these things happen. When do ice sheets collapse, and how quickly does that happen? At this stage, we can't tell you how quickly. We know that it obviously takes some time. So as you warm the Earth's atmosphere, it will take some time for the ice sheets to respond. But a lot of the research that's come out, even I'd say in the last decade, is really pointing us towards thinking that the ice sheets can respond a lot quicker than we used to think they could. So it's not going to happen overnight. You're not going to get 30 feet of sea level rise, right? But the point I like to make to people is you really have to start to think about what commitment are we making to sea level rise? Because if we warm the atmosphere by, you know, a couple degrees at the poles, we're going to cross that within a matter of decades, right? So we may be committing ourselves to this type of sea level rise in the future for the future generations.
If we look into history, sometimes it's a good predictor, sometimes it's not a good predictor to the future. What can we look at historically that might give us some guidance? Brian Fagan?
Practically nothing. I mean, as Andrew's pointed out, and this is really important research they're doing. I mean, they're really attacking the million-dollar question. The basic variable is there were just so many people. And there is no precedent that really would tell you how people will react and what we can do. We're really on our own, in my humble opinion.
Andrea?
So historically, there actually is a lot we can learn, not necessarily about what's going to happen, but what has happened tells us a lot about the system. So if we look at, there are sea level records that have been generated over, say, the past 2,000 years in great detail, looking at salt marsh sediments. And what they tell us is that for most of that 2,000 years, there were pretty minor changes in sea level. But in the late 1800s, that sea level started to rise dramatically, just about the same time as temperature rose dramatically due to industrialization and putting CO2 into the atmosphere. So what we can say is this type of sea level rise within the past 2,000 years is unprecedented, right? So we can see there's this really rapid response of sea level to changes in temperatures, and that's an important thing we can take away from the historical record.
Yeah, but it's a fairly shallow historical record by my standards, but she's absolutely right. This is very, very important.
Brian Fagan, would you say, since you're kind of looking at this from the big picture of what are we going to do as a humanity, would you say that primarily what people have to do now is start planning to adjust?
Yes. I think a number of things got to happen. I think one of them is that we've really got to start thinking about this. It's a political issue. It's a very complex economic and social issue. And we really need to start planning. The problem is that our whole system and life is set up for short-term thinking. And this is a problem for our great-grandchildren. About the only people who are thinking about this in the long term that I know of, the Dutch. And they're planning for, Andrew may know the figure, but I think it's 100,000-year events, something like that. And that's a very long feeling. And even them, I know, are having some resistance from the present generation. Why should we pay for this? And things like that. These are the sort of issues which are going to become more and more prevalent as this situation intensifies. But at the moment, there is no serious thinking about it in most countries in the world.
Andrea Dutton, where do you see the future of your research with what you've now discovered?
It's pretty clear to us that during this last interglacial period that the West Antarctic ice sheet pretty much collapsed. So large portions of this ice sheet are currently grounded below sea level. So it can be pretty sensitive to warming ocean waters from underneath the ice shelf, and it can retreat very rapidly. So we're pretty sure that this collapsed during that time period, and we're debating about when it happened, under what conditions, and how quickly. So this is one of the directions that we're moving into, and we're trying to understand, you know, did sea level rise gradually, or was it very rapid? Is it kind of a nonlinear response? Those are the types of things that are going to be really important knowledge to have as we move into the future.
What Andrew's doing is of enormous importance, because what they're addressing, they're using the remote past, the recent past, to look at what might happen. And they're doing it in very realistic terms, which is scientifically intelligible to a wide audience. And this, to me, is enormously important.
Well, thank you both so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Thank you for having me.
Andrea Dutton is a professor in the Department of Geological Sciences at the University of Florida. She is the author of Ice Volumes and Sea Level During the Last Interglacial that was published in the journal Science. Brian Fagan is an emeritus professor of anthropology at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He's the author of more than 40 books, including his latest, The Attacking Ocean, The Past, Present, and Future of Rising Sea Levels. When we come back, how identity can cause violence and how to make peace in the aftermath. Stay tuned. This is the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. How do you make peace after fatal conflicts and loss of lands? And what is the role of identity in the conflict and in the peacemaking? With us are two experts. Neophytis Louisidis is a professor of international conflict analysis at the University of Kent and the author of The Politics of Majority Nationalism, Framing Peace, Stalemates in Crises, and Designing Peace, Cyprus and Institutional Innovations in Divided Societies. Madhura Vasaratnam is a lecturer in comparative politics at the City University of London and the author of Tamils in the Nation, India and Sri Lanka Compared.
Well, welcome to the Scholar Circle. It's great to have the two of you with us. You've both done some really interesting work with conflict, with peacemaking, with nationalism, with identity. I thought perhaps what we should do is start with identity, because it seems to play a really big role in everything today. Madhura and I, you and I were just talking a little while ago about how even what we see now in the United States seems like it's such a divided society based on some sorts of identity. So maybe we should start with identity politics in the first place. What do you think we need to know, Madhura, about identity, its formation, and the roles that it plays in our politics?
Thank you for that. That's a really interesting way of framing it. I think for me, and what my research has been concerned about, is really a specific form of identity, which is national identity. So we all have these multiple identities. We move in different spaces where we have identities as siblings, as partners, as friends, etc. But there's a particular form of national identity, which most of the time we don't think about, but sometimes it becomes really acute for some people in some places. And globally at the moment, it's becoming very acute for all kinds of reasons, economic distress and what have you. And national identity is important, although we don't think about it a lot, because it determines where we can go, where we can live, where we have political rights, where we might have social rights, where we have the right to work, what kind of state we have access to. Some people are born in states that deny them citizenship, for example, the Rohingya in Burma at the moment. And other people find themselves in states where perhaps the state wants to exclude them from the national identity. So my kind of focus is really, we have multiple forms of identity, and most of the time our national identity doesn't really matter to us. But for some people in some places, in sites of intense conflict, national identity matters a great deal, because it's about access to these really crucial goods like citizenship, the right to vote, the right to work, the right to live safely. And so my work is really about how is it that some states which have, you know, a diverse group of people, religious, linguistic diversity, most states have these types of diversities. Some states can manage this diversity and find a way of including this diversity within their understanding of the national whole. And in other states, this becomes a site of sort of intense and polarized conflict, and some groups of people get excluded or marginalized, or, you know, as we see happening in Burma right now, actually physically pushed out of the border.
You know, what would you add to that?
Madhura already said the most important points on this. If one notices how many conflicts we have in the world right now involving identity, we might be tempted to say that there is an overwhelming tendency to associate identities with conflict. We look at Kurdish regions in Iraq, we look at Catalonia as recent examples where we actually have the public voting in referendums in favor of having their own states that would represent their own national identities. At the same time, as Madhura has pointed, there is majority of cases where we don't see these identities emerging in confrontational ways. In most cases, we've seen accommodation, or we have seen groups not fighting necessarily for what they aspire to. And there are different kinds of identity nationalism. Myself, I focus on majority nationalism. Why majorities do not want to compromise with minorities, why they don't want to share power, why they often break relations with other countries and neighbors, why majority nationalism does not welcome migrants in many of the occasions that we see around the world, why there is a strong feeling against migration in many established nations. Another major question of identity. And also, why often we get into situations where there is a minority-majority conflict that becomes intractable in what we usually refer to as deeply divided society. Small places that could be much happier if they had some kind of political accommodation, yet this majority-minority syndrome prevents them from reaching some kind of political accommodation.
And there are so many questions that I could ask you just based on what you said, like, well, why is it that majorities look at minority identities and don't want to welcome them, say, for example, the refugees, or in the case of Burma that Madura was talking about, actually pushes out the Rohingya? What are you finding in that?
In some cases, it might be because of history. The presence of a minority might not be seen as legitimate because newcomers were not originally welcome. They might be a product of a colonial legacy. Majorities in general would not like to share power. There is a feeling that every person should have equal vote. And often that means that minorities might not receive some form of political equality. It's very hard to convince a majority that they have to share power with a minority at an equal standing. That's a very difficult decision for any majority to accept, unless there is some kind of broader political compromise, as we have seen in some of the Balkan cases, for instance, in Bosnia, in some of the Central African cases, such as Burundi, for instance. But even there is a feeling that if we're a majority, we should have a say of what the country would look like. That often creates a temptation for the minority to fear that they're going to be excluded. And if they can't, and if they have the military capacity to do so, as we have seen in northern Iraq with the Kurds, and we have seen historically with the Tamils in Sri Lanka, the temptation for those groups is to seek their own independence, their own state.
Madura, he mentioned Sri Lanka. I know that's one of the areas that you've been studying. And one of the phrases that you used there was Buddhist nationalism. Is that part of what Neo is talking about?
Exactly. It fits in very much into this idea of majoritarian nationalism. I mean, Sri Lanka is a kind of exemplary case of the types of majority-minority dynamics that Neo was talking about. And also Burma, actually, you can think about Buddhist nationalism in that case. And the dynamic in Sri Lanka is exactly that. So as kind of independence from Britain approached in the early 20th century, political leaders and political actors were having a choice. How do you frame the nation that is about to become independent? Is this going to be a nation that includes sort of everybody? Is it a pan-Sri Lankan or a pan-Sudanese nation in which you're kind of identified by your political rights and your citizenship rights, and which is inclusive of linguistic and religious diversity? Or is the more politically attractive option to say, well, this is a country that belongs to the Sinhala Buddhists primarily? And as Neo mentioned, there's a historical dynamic whereby if you're not a Sinhala Buddhist, so if you're a Tamil or if you're a Muslim or if you're a Christian, let's say, your presence is seen as illegitimate somehow as due to the influence of colonialism. In the Tamil case, it's the influence of very historic kind of colonialism of the early Middle Ages and then later waves of colonialism. So there's a historical narrative which says, well, the original people are Sinhala Buddhists and these other people are sort of, as Neo would say, illegitimate migrants who don't deserve the same national rights as the majority, as the true sort of the sons of the soil. I mean, you mentioned that you're in the United States. You can see similar discourses there about who's the real America? Is it the middle America, or is it these elites on the coasts, or what have you?
And we also saw the nativist thing. Conversation, that nativist idea.
Nativist, yeah. And we saw the same thing in the UK. We've just recently been through a very tumultuous year of referendums, including a referendum to leave the EU, in which, you know, there was this idea that there were the real British people who wanted to leave, real people, and the so-called other non-real British people who wanted to stay in the EU.
One of the things you wrote in your book, Madhura, had to do with identity formation, sort of. I'm probably botching that up a little bit. But you talked about how these identities can be sort of deliberately constructed.
Yes, I think that's right. It's a somewhat awkward idea in some ways and counterintuitive because, you know, nationalist movements will often claim that they have these deep and ancient historic roots and that they're not constructed. But the argument really is that although nationalism is the site of often this violent, intense and violent conflict, it really doesn't have to be that way. There are alternatives. There are alternative ways of framing national identity. And so my study was really a comparison of India and Sri Lanka. And the question is, well, India has these similar dynamics, or it has the potential for these similar dynamics of majoritarian nationalism and exclusion. And up until recently, India has done a relatively better job at managing those. Relative, I mean, it's not absolute. And so my argument really is that the reason for that is that there's a way in which Indian nationalism was constructed by the Indian nationalist movement from the late 19th century, which was this idea that India is a unity in diversity. So it was a kind of inclusive, pan-linguistic, pan-ethnic nationalist movement. And to some extent, this idea was able to hold this diversity together reasonably successfully for several decades. It is, of course, being critically undermined now by the rise of the Hindu nationalist movement. But nevertheless, we can see that there's a possibility for having a more inclusive idea of who belongs in India. And so what I try to do in my kind of comparison of India and Sri Lanka is to think about why a similar form of pan-Sri Lankan nationalism didn't emerge in Sri Lanka, even though the conditions in Sri Lanka would suggest that it was actually more, that the conditions were more favorable for such a sort of movement, but it didn't happen. And then you had a much more rapid escalation of conflict in Sri Lanka.
Neo, you've looked at quite a few conflicts yourself, including the one from your home country, Cyprus. How do these other conflicts compare with how Madhura is describing what's going on with, or what has happened with Sri Lanka?
I agree with the observation that Madhura has made that institutions are not a panacea in addressing some of these conflicts. However, if we look at federations, since World War II, no federal country has failed, at least in the what we call the developed democratic countries. Even in the developing countries, has been working fairly well. We hear all the time about political instability in Belgium, political instability in Spain, but these are conflicts that have not led to any major calamities, no deaths recorded. Often there is a crisis that is being negotiated slowly, but eventually reaching some sort of stable outcome. We know that some institutions do not work very well. So when I was writing my book, I was very pessimistic about the use of referendums. I was about 2 years ago when I completed that book. I see since then there are not many people who will support referendums in addressing complex problems. I think referendums tend to promote the negative aspects of identities, if you wish. And I think the Brexit case, the Colombian case, the Catalan, the Kurdish referendums are recent cases that testify to that. So we know that some institutions that promote inclusivity and power sharing tend to sustain stability in some of these deeply divided societies. But there is a limitation to this argument because often there is such a historical record that it's very difficult to negotiate with those institutions in the first place.
So when we talk about institutions and power sharing, one of the cases that you had looked at was Northern Ireland, and that's how you and I met actually originally. And I know from my work in Northern Ireland that people kind of feel like that institutionalized the identity sectarianism. How do you see that?
I slightly disagree with that. I agree with the observation. There's a lot of reactions from Northern Irish people about their own political institutions. I think they're not selling their own successes very well. When I went there as a Cypriot, it took me a while to realize how Northern Ireland operates. And it operates in a very simple formula. There is a proportional system of representation. So minority, which is at this stage in their history, the nationalists, they might become a majority at some point in the distant future, are proportionally represented in the assembly. The assembly was oversized. It was more than 100 MPs at some point. And the idea there was to include the smallest groups possible. The other important innovation was that in accordance to how many seats you have in the parliament, in accordance to your electoral strength, you also automatically have the right to be represented in the cabinet. That's almost a unique feature of the Northern Irish system. And given how simple and attractive this idea could be for others' conflict, I was puzzled myself why British policymakers didn't try to promote this idea in other divided societies. So it's a very simple idea if you think of the conflict in Syria right now or in Cyprus, since you mentioned my own work on Cyprus. The simplest way of promoting inclusivity is to say to every group that you're going to be automatically represented according to your electoral strength. If there is an important decision that affects your future, then you might have also the right to veto that decision because we don't want you to be negatively affected by the democratic process. Very, very simple idea for places like Nepal, where you have multiple groups. Very simple idea for places like Syria, where you have, again, a multiplicity of ethnic and religious affiliations. So those institutions can be also very simple and elegant. They can be negotiated fairly quickly and do not necessarily lead to these very complex negotiations after having elections that we have seen in places like Belgium, where it's difficult to form a government, or places like Iraq, where you do have quotas for every group, or in Lebanon, but often there is a dominant majority and a dominant leader who finds allies within other groups and supports those allies. There is some kind of token is there, and they appoint their where they appoint their own friends from the other community in key positions. The group itself feels somehow not represented. The system in Northern Ireland is inclusive in the sense that people vote democratically for those political parties. And what I disagree with many of the scholars in Northern Ireland is that they see it as strengthening sectarianism. And it's true, the Northern Irish public still votes and votes in higher numbers, higher percentages for parties that tend to represent the sectarian lines within Northern Ireland. That's their choice, and that's a democratic choice, one can say. But also the counterpoint to that is that political parties such as Sinn Féin or DUP that have been historically very entrenched on sectarian identity terms have also moderated their own positions.
Madhura, would you agree with this?
I would agree with that. I think that although I'm somewhat skeptical about the ameliorative power of institutions, I also think that when you do have a deeply divided society, and you want to move forward from that, you have to come up with solutions. And one of the key problems is about sharing political power. How is political power to be distributed? And there you have to have institutional solutions. And as Neil says, I mean, if you, as in Northern Ireland or in Sri Lanka, you have to take the facts as they are. And people do vote along ethnic lines in Sri Lanka, in Northern Ireland. And if you simply allow a kind of majoritarian system to operate, which would be the one where you ignore ethnicity and you try and have a first past the post system and don't have proportionality, then you will refeed the dynamics of the conflict about majoritarianism and minority exclusion. This is just based on my comparison of India and Sri Lanka, is that, of course, what would be absolutely ideal is to have some form of nationalist mobilization before political power that is inclusive. So that is the ideal outcome. And so somewhere like India, South Africa, maybe with the ANC, which is, you know, to some extent ethnically inclusive of a range of different groups and different political persuasions, like the Indian National Congress was at some point, that is the ideal outcome. You have a powerful, inclusive, broad-based nationalist movement that can then set about creating an institutional framework in its own image that can consolidate a sort of inclusive sense of national identity for several decades after independence. But, you know, that is not an outcome you can engineer. And if you haven't had that historical legacy, then what do you do in situations of conflict? And I think in those situations, as in Northern Ireland, you have to take the facts as they are. And the facts as they are is that people tend to be politically aligned along nationalist unionist lines. And that is also the source of the conflict. So institutions in some way have to be able to reflect and negotiate that. Because, I mean, there is no way now for policy to create a unified Northern Irish nationalist movement.
Just a reminder that you're listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian, and we are talking about violent conflict over contested lands in Sri Lanka, Cyprus, the Balkans, and Northern Ireland.
Neo, you used a phrase in your book, and it was kind of the key phrase of the book, innovative institutions. And that could mean a lot of things to a lot of people. What do you mean by this?
This is a broad term that covers a wide range of political accommodation, conflict mitigating mechanisms. If you're looking at the conflict, you don't have the luxury to ignore any of those. In fact, what you often have to do is to combine them together. The reason is that if you're a majority, as we said, that you're not willing to sacrifice power, share power, there might be something in another domain that you might get in return. So it's very important to look at them together. So one community provides power sharing, but the other community sacrifices on security or the right of return or any other aspect of the peace settlement, federalism, that is very important to the other community who's making their own concession. So one can look at various domains. One could be power sharing. The other one is how you ratify a peace settlement. Do you ratify the peace settlement in a parliament? Does one ratify it in a referendum, which doesn't seem to be working in many of the cases recently? Does one ratify it in a constitutional convention? Could it be a combination? And how do you institutionalize those solutions? The same with power sharing can take very different forms. And the micro dynamics, the micro institutional details are very important. Federalism can be designed in very different forms. One can look at Canada versus United States. They're both federations, they're both in North America, and they're very distinctive. Same with Europe. Countries like Spain or Switzerland or Belgium are very, very different to each other. Even within countries like the United Kingdom, the way Northern Ireland or Wales or Scotland are being treated are very, very different. So you have variations on that. And then you have a third category of institutions that deals with victims of ethnic conflict and that involves institutions that affect victims of displacement on how are situated within the peace settlement. It involves others who are owners of properties who might be migrants or settlers. We have also the question of settlers in many of the conflicts, or what is defined as settler can be also very difficult in some cases if there has been a generation of people living there. And then you have people who have lost their relatives during the conflict, so victims of conflict who might not know even where their beloved ones are buried. So we have the question of missing persons and what kind of institutions of transitional justice deal with the criminals, people who are trying to provide some truth that might lead to the recovery of those processes. So all these institutions are quite interlinked in my analysis. Can one look at the toolbox of institutional solutions that have been employed in other cases? And is there anything we can import for Cyprus, in the case of my book, and other divided societies that might interest the field more broadly?
And speaking of Cyprus, since you are from there and since you have studied Cyprus, the peace agreement that they were trying to bring about has not succeeded. What do you make of that?
Well, there is the different interpretations. If you look at the political sides in Cyprus, they blame each other. It's not unsurprising. My own work, I try to look at institutions, try to look at the broader picture. So if one looks at what is recommended, let's say, by the scholarship, by the latest that has been written on those topics and what has been done in Cyprus, one could see a contradiction. So most scholars, for instance, they talk about having a parliamentary system being more conducive to these kinds of political experiments. In Cyprus, they're trying to have a presidential system. Most political scientists will argue after the Brexit and Colombia referendum that we have been very cautious with the use of referendums. In Cyprus, it has become part of the initial agreement that any peace settlement will have to be ratified in a referendum. Most scholars and most evidence from divided society talks about broader inclusivity in the peace processes. Yet in Cyprus, instead of engaging with the civil society and engaging with a wider network of political parties, the negotiations are always occurring between two leaders, one Turkish Cypriot and one Greek Cypriot. Then there is the question of victims. The way we negotiated the most important issue so far on properties for those who have lost their properties is a priority, obviously, was to try to have top-down criteria on what to do with the properties. And very little has been done to consult the affected persons, owners and users at the same time. So there can be a much longer list of what is done differently to the conventional practice. And one might not expect that you might get good outcomes if you do everything in contradiction with what is with respect. A much bigger issue for the Greek Cypriots is security. Greek Cypriots fear that a very unstable Turkey and a relationship with that might harm them. And for the Turkish Cypriots, it's very important that they retain a status of their own, a territory in the northern part of the island. Yet if they do so, and the terms that they often aspire may not be at the interest of the Greek Cypriot majority. So there again, we have this question of what will incentivize Greek Cypriots to accept a solution that is also compatible with the Turkish Cypriot aspirations.
Madura, what about Sri Lanka and what has happened since the civil war essentially ended? I mean, that was an incredibly bloody conflict.
That's right. And it ended in May 2009 amidst these kind of mass atrocities with dynamics that are very, very similar to what's happening in Burma at the moment. And really, I think where Sri Lanka is now is it's post-war, but it's not post-conflict. In some ways, the conflict has actually deepened and intensified in ways that are quite difficult to untangle. So, for example, there's a recent report by a research institute based in Jaffna, actually, where they've done quite detailed mapping of the levels of militarization in the former war zones, which are predominantly Tamil-speaking, and in the areas where the last phases of the conflict took place. The levels of militarization are now that there is one soldier to every two civilians. And so the Sri Lankan military, you know, because of this wave of post-independence majoritarianism, the Sri Lankan military is exclusively Sinhalese. And the population in these former areas is Tamil. This is the population that has, you know, suffered the worst kind of brunt of the war. Many people who have missing relatives, people who are in the final stages of the war, witnessed the mass atrocities, then black people disappeared. And now they're living in the midst of that military levels of militarization of one soldier to two civilians. At the same time, there's no movement at all on any kind of political resolution or any form of sort of at least truth-telling, at least some sense of, you know, that one of the key demands that's being made by Tamil civil society protests, including by there's an ongoing protest now, which is in its almost, I think it's 220 days by Mothers of the Disappeared. And really all they want is that the Sri Lankan government, one of its own commissions, has acknowledged that it has a list of all the people that it took into custody at the end of the war, who have subsequently not been heard of. And all they want is they want that list to be published. So at least they have an official acknowledgement that, yes, my brother, sister, husband, father, was taken into custody. So we can now start an official process of finding where they are, but that list has not been released. The demand is for the list, just to release the list, just so we can know that you acknowledge that you took my loved one into custody. And so this, you know, this ethnic polarization is deepening, but at the same time, it's also the case that Sri Lanka simply is, as a whole, is very precarious. So to sustain this level of militarization in a country that, you know, is growing but is still relatively poor costs an enormous amount of money. So the Sri Lankan military is 300,000 people in a country that the population is 20 million. So for comparison, the British military, I think, is about 150,000 people with a population of 60 million. This is, you know, one of the highest kind of ratios of military personnel to civilians. And Sri Lanka is not quite in a debt crisis, but has starting to have critically unmanageable levels of debt, a lot of it commercial debt, obviously because of this large expenditure on the military. So you can see that the ethnic polarization is deepening, and this is also kind of feeding a sort of political and economic instability in the country as a whole. And unless really very quickly very pragmatic steps are taken to de-escalate, this can only get more and more unstable. It's difficult to see how it can stabilize in this way at, you know, these levels of militarization, this level of hostility, and this level of kind of really unmanaged expenditure on a military that seems to be just there to sort of police and survey and repress a sort of absolutely war-exhausted population.
Has there been any movement to resolve this?
As I said, there are various kind of efforts at instituting transitional justice processes and constitutional reform processes. But the important thing to remember is that Sri Lankan leaders, because of the long duration of the war, it was 3 decades, and the international engagement in the war by Western states and by India, all of whom in various ways, you know, sought a resolution to the crisis, ineptly sometimes fueled the war, but nevertheless were deeply engaged in the war. Sri Lankan political leaders are really very expert at engaging the international community on a superficial level. So they've developed a way of kind of producing commissions, instigating committees, initiating processes as a means of taking on board international demands for political reform or power sharing or transitional justice or accountability or human rights reform. So as a means of accommodating these demands, they're very good at instituting fairly superficial processes that then just drag on for years and years and years with no outcome. So there's a constitutional reform process ongoing at the moment. This will be Sri Lanka's fourth. It's not third time lucky, fourth time lucky. I think that the chances are unlikely. What's been released so far of the draft report suggests that the majoritarian features will remain in place. So it's unclear how this is in advance. And as I said, if was a genuine commitment, you would start by movement on small things like releasing the list of people who were detained, like movement on political prisoners, like repealing the Prevention of Terrorism Act, like the military releasing privately owned lands that it's occupied for decades. And, you know, privately owned lands in the Jaffna Peninsula, which is overpopulated, where land is very expensive. But this doesn't seem to be. I was in Jaffna over the summer. It's very clear that the military is digging in, and not only digging in a military way, but it's also digging in the sense that it's engaging in commercial enterprises, right? Use it on privately owned land. And not only is that legally normatively problematic, but of course, when the military starts to run hotels, engage in farming, run hairdressing salons, run grocery shops, this pushes out the space for local people, which is what the Sri Lanka, because of course you have 300,000 soldiers who are very expensive to maintain. So they have to become self-sufficient, so they engage in economic activity. So the military runs holiday resorts on privately owned land, while the people who own that land sit in refugee camps outside. I mean, Sri Lanka is the end of the war really was just a trigger for a deepening institutionalization of the conflict, actually. Because the war at least provided the moments where there was a balance of forces and perhaps a negotiation, but the end of the war has allowed for a really entrenched and deepening institutionalization of certain really repressive patterns, at which at the same time incredibly precarious, because they're not financially sustainable, they're not economically sustainable.
When you were talking about entrenched power and superficiality, I was thinking about how that seems like a common dynamic when you are dealing with, like Neo was talking about, majoritarian power, and the people in power don't want to give up power. And so, yes, they give it some lip service. Yeah, we're look at all the things that we're trying to do. Look, everybody, we're trying to bring peace. I mean, I can think of so many of those situations. But when you started talking about the essential usurpation of all, you know, activities that would normally be within the civil society, I have not heard of anything like that before.
I haven't done the read. No, I need to do like full comparison. But I think if you look at the levels of militarization in especially Mundathiba, this place where the last stages of the war were fought, where this figure of, you know, one soldier for two civilians, I can't think of a place that would be that militarized. Kashmir doesn't reach that level. Even Chechnya at the height of conflict doesn't reach that level. And in that district, you know, the military is effectively kind of has a commanding role in directing economic activity, in doling out livelihood opportunities. You know, the military has kind of become the sole employer almost, because it's very difficult for anybody else to start up a business there, because you need to get the right permits, you need to get permission, you need to buy land. And of course, who decides the land can be sold to and not sold to? So, I mean, this is really a fairly unique form of institutionalization of majoritarianism, very problematic and very worrying. And of course, the deeper it gets, the more traumatic it'll be when it unwinds. And it will have to unwind. I mean, it's completely unviable. It's politically unviable. It's economically unviable.
Neo, have you ever seen anything quite like that in any of the studies that you've done?
I think Cyprus comes very close to the ratio that Madura has mentioned. The Turkish military in the northern part of the island is about 1 to 3 civilians, Turkish Cypriot civilians, not counting the people who came from Turkey since 1974, that one can argue that they're part of the same operation. But the very interesting issue and comparison, I think, is how the military competition between Greece and Turkey and the confrontation has harmed both countries. In the case of Turkey, we have seen chronic mismanagement, chronic crisis, economic crisis, which partly relate to the very large budget and, of course, all kinds of political problems Turkey faced because of the clash between military and civilian parties. In Greece, a part of the reason that the Greek economy has suffered such a major, unprecedented for non-wartime economy crisis was the military competition, the military expenditure and the import of arms to keep up with a much larger country such as Turkey. A lot of people will find it ironic, but a few days ago, the Greek Prime Minister, Mr. Tsipras, came to Washington and negotiated a new deal to upgrade Greek airplanes. And a lot of people in Europe found it quite frustrating that Greek economy and the Greek people are going in such a harsh time. But the Greek Prime Minister is meeting Donald Trump, and Donald Trump is boasting that we're going to have more American jobs selling military equipment to Greece. They found it quite frustrating. There's a lot of reactions in European media, and rightly so, because some of the Europeans are covering these. There are a lot of unhidden costs as well. It's not just the military expenditure. That's, as far as I know, in Sri Lanka as well, in Greece, people are not paid to serve in the military. Often they are recruited as part of their own time. Turkish EU accession might have been a possibility 10 years ago. It didn't happen again because of this competition with Greece, improvement of relations between these countries and their neighborhood has not happened because, again, of the competition. So we're all constrained and we're all losers as part of conflicts. The fact that we cannot reach a political compromise has its economic costs as well as social, political, and military ones.
It really sounds dark.
If I can jump in. It can be very depressing to speak about Sri Lanka, but I don't think that it's not all darkness. The other thing that was also present when I went to Sri Lanka over the summer is, yes, I mean, it's very clear that there is this deepening and this deep institutionalization of these patterns of militarization. But there's also enormous resilience. And, you know, people continue to sort of mobilize, they continue to protest, they continue to seek new forms of politics, to push for a more inclusive society, to push for their rights. And so I think these things never really stand still, so long as there are people who continue to mobilize and to seek something different. And they do, despite, you know, these intense, Sri Lanka has witnessed in the north and the south some very intense levels of repression, then there's hope.
Neil?
Maria, you and I met in Northern Ireland, so you know very well from your own research that very few people were expecting the Good Friday Belfast Agreement. Polls, but also general statements in the press at the time, a year, a month before the agreement, were very negative, very pessimistic. And we have seen in many other conflicts, people are usually not expecting good news, but often good news might emerge and good stories might emerge. I agree with Madura. There is a resilience in many of the peace processes that we looked at, that we often don't necessarily pay the appropriate attention. In Cyprus, there are a good number of bicommunal projects that have been successful, starting from the Committee for Missing Persons, who have successfully recovered almost half of the bodies of the missing from the conflict of 1963, 64, 1974, but also projects that involve the restoration of cultural properties, dialogue between religious groups, dialogue between business groups. There have been so many different projects in just a small island such as Cyprus that give us some element of optimism that at least at the level of the people, if people are left and if they are encouraged through the appropriate leadership and appropriate institutions, we might see a positive outcome sometime very soon.
Thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholars Circle and sharing your research and sharing your wisdom. It's been a great pleasure to host you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Neophytis Louisidis is a professor of international conflict analysis at the University of Kent and the author of The Politics of Majority Nationalism, Framing Peace, Stalemates in Crises, and Designing Peace, Cyprus and Institutional Innovations in Divided Societies. Madura Vasaratnam is a lecturer in comparative politics at the City University of London and the author of Tamils in the Nation, India and Sri Lanka Compared. And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Anais Amin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page. Most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
If we want to see